Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Today's special guest is Ken Lewis, the founder of New Riff Distillery. This is a stop on the Craft Bourbon Trail in Kentucky. But for anybody who goes to the Party Source, which he also founded and has since sold, it's right next door. So it's right over the river. Door. I'm looking forward to talking to him about rave reviews for the bourbon. And it's kind of in an unexpected place. But I think if you know Ken, everything I've ever heard about him is he puts such care into everything he does. And I'm a big fan of that. Go big or go home.
I have many questions for Ken, as I enjoy bourbon, but I'm nowhere near being like an expert or an aficionado. So I'm hoping we can learn some things from Ken.
Agree.
Yeah.
Now, all right. Just pretend I know about bourbon. That's the best thing about this podcast. I learn things as we go along, and then I just whip out this detail or that detail from people who are experts in them, and I sound really knowledgeable about a lot of different things.
I'll try to carry this one.
Okay.
This is in my wheelhouse. So, but your wheelhouse is news.
It is.
And I thought today, there's not really like any screaming headlines, but there are a few things that we need to like, I think, get caught up on. Like first and foremost is, what's going on with the Sittenfeld trial?
Well, I have a little callus on my finger here from hitting refresh on PACER.
And for those who don't know, PACER is?
It is the federal court system where you can search court records for things that are going on. I have to say, we're really in a waiting and holding pattern. He has three, you know, really big motions before the court. He's seeking a new trial. He's seeking a mistrial based on juror misconduct alleged. He's seeking a new trial and an acquittal, all different things. These things are all going to take different paths. They have to be briefed. There might be oral arguments. It's the case that will go on forever.
So the three motions, the most, I think, probably damning for the prosecution is the motion for mistrial because of jury misconduct. What are you hearing about how that might go?
So I am doubtful that it's going anywhere because there was a hearing in which the Sittenfeld lawyers, they would like to do a forensic analysis of her phone and computer. And the answer was no. The answer was no from the current judge. The answer was no already from an appeals court because that's just a bridge too far. Both of those decisions said this person who may or may not have committed this, you know, they talked about what she said in the hearings, and she said, no, I didn't read the story. Sure, you know, somebody posted it. Sure, somebody mentioned Sittenfeld to me and all this outside information, but she said that she was not biased, and we have to go by her word because everybody, these courts were like a bridge too far. We're not seizing a juror who is doing civic duty. We're not taking her phone from her. That is not how America works. She did not commit a crime. And so everyone's kind of left really with they have to take her word on it. And her word is that she, you know, there was no bias.
But the judge still has to decide, correct?
He does. He does. And so we're waiting for that.
And I know that trying to get a timeline from our judicial system is almost as difficult as it is to get a timeline from like a housing contractor who's working on your roof. Like, how long is this going to take? Oh, two weeks. There's a movie about that, by the way. With Tom Hanks called The Money Pit, right? But what's your gut tell you?
I don't think we really – well, we have to hear something, some sort of rulings. But then even in that point, they're going to spark appeals from either side, no matter which way it goes. So it just really means that the case continues on to the appeals portion of things. So I think that this drags on. The sentencing portion has not even started yet. So I don't think we see any sentence until next summer.
At least until they're through the appeals, probably.
Yes.
Okay. So, well, hurry up and wait, I guess.
I know. We're paying close attention, though. It's very nuanced, but I somehow have it all tucked in my head.
Well, you know the details. So, all right, switching gears. You know, we're talking a lot about Election Day coming up. We're hearing a lot about J.D. Vance and Tim Ryan. We're hearing a lot about how, you know, Mike DeWine seems to be, you know, coasting to an easy win here. We're not talking a whole lot about the Hamilton County Commission race. So I thought we would just kind of spend a minute talking about that. And the reason is I'm not steeped in it like you are, like Scott Wortman is, like Jason Williams is. Even though Jason is writing sports now, he still is following things from the politics world. I was talking to Jason last night, and I said, you know, what do you think about Smitherman's chance
to— That would be Jason Williams.
Jason Williams.
Who, while he's not writing a political column, is still very steeped. I hear him taking the calls and everything. It's something he's interested in. He's still really following along, I know.
Well, I said, I think Smitherman has a chance, and Jason just laughed, like, no way, no how. Stephanie Dumas, who's a Democrat, and now she's endorsed this time, you know, people are going to vote straight party tickets. The Democrats are just going to look for the D and vote for Stephanie. You know, Chris Smitherman, former Cincinnati vice mayor, city council member, is an independent. And that's a tough way to get elected as an independent in this town, in this county. There is a, you know, by the way, Republican candidate that is probably going to take a little bit of votes, take some votes away from Chris. And so I get all of that. You know, I get the math. I get the logic and how you experts predict this as an easy win for Stephanie Dumas. But just from a casual observer, he's campaigning his butt off right now. And she's not really out there. Do you think that's a factor?
That's because she doesn't need to be.
All right. Well,
all right. I covered Christopher Smitherman for a long time, and I agree he definitely has name recognition. But when people are going in the ballot box, they are looking for that D and the R. But really, and you know what? Kudos to him. The entire, you know, everyone is like, just be an R. Switch. Just be an R. Don't be an I. Be an R. And it's now in his heart. He's an independent, and that was something that was very important to his wife, Pamela, who died a few years ago. And he stuck to his guns and said, even though it would have helped him to switch to an R, and he's very middle of the road, the I really does suit him in things I've seen him do, he said, no, I'm staying with it. So the Republicans said, then we have to find a candidate to endorse that candidate. Now, I can't believe I'm admitting this out loud, but fine, I'll just do it. I cannot remember his name, and that has been a thing
that's
the entire
very telling.
Time.
Yeah.
More times I have looked. I read Scott Wortman's story 2 days ago about these candidates, and I have I've looked it up a couple times because people ask me, and I'm like, "What? Who is that?" I feel I'm sorry, you guys, but if somebody myself who's in the know, like I have to follow the news, it's my job.
Right? No, so
it's shocking. But here's why I think that Stephanie does win this. Stephanie who in 2018 when she won, and she just put up huge numbers without doing the campaigning. I learned a lot, honestly, from that race about our county. And we can't – you are from Forest Park. She worked there. People love her and know her from that time. And she's very big in the church community here. Bishop Bobby Hilton is her chief of staff. You cannot discount what is happening. When it comes to voting, what is happening in the churches in this community, they drive a lot, and that matters. And I think that's what this race is going to boil down to. Now, Christopher does have his own church community. I just don't think it's enough to overcome her D and her church community together.
I you're probably right, but I like a good bet. So Jason and I have a gentleman's
no bets
bet
for me.
Yes, Jason and I have a gentleman's bet that if Smitherman wins, he's buying my lunch at Price Hill Chili. So we'll say hi to our friend Chris Beltzos. And if Stephanie wins, then I'm buying lunch. And if Matt O'Neill wins, I had to look it up too. But you know, in interest of being fair, we'll mention Matt's name, the Republican candidate for Hamilton County Commission. If he wins, then it's a push and we go Dutch. So,
oh, interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I might crash that. I live right by there.
That would be fun. Okay. Last question.
So, wait, I do want to say one of the reasons I think we don't know a lot about this race is there's not TV. If I see one more Landsman and Chabot ad, either way, themselves for themselves or themselves against the other person,
right.
I have them memorized.
It's
the AFTAB race all over again.
It is. And I wonder where they find that guy with the haunting voice.
I know. That seems like a good gig to get.
I know, right? You know, I think I can do that.
So anyway, I think
Greg Landsman. He's very bad.
That's the voice, right?
Yes, but you keep...
And that's basically what he said.
That's not what you were thinking, though. That's just...
Steve Chabot. He's bad, too.
So...
How'd I do, Phil? That's good. You. Can they hear Phil? Okay, Phil just said he's going to add some cool sound effects, so we'll see what that sounds like.
So,
all right,
please do read Scott Wortman's story. I know about the candidate, even though didn't retain the name. He worked really hard on that, and Scott is covering a lot of our election coverage, and it's a pile onto him. And I've offered to help some, but he says that he has it well in hand. But please don't miss his stories.
No, his story really frames out the issues. You know, the big one that's going to be in front of them for this, you know, after this election will be negotiations starting for a new lease for the stadium we now call
Paycor. It's unavoidable. Like, that's going to be the biggest thing.
All right. Last question I have for you, or last topic I want to touch on, because this is a Sherry Coolidge scoop. And back to Scott Wortman. Do you know, listeners, that Scott has a nameplate on his desk? It says Scott Scoop Wortman.
It faces my desk. I read
it's
every day.
It's the coolest thing. He got it from like his family and everything like that. And Scott has his fair scoop. So you had a big scoop last week, and that's that unbeknownst to most people, there was a failure in the Cincinnati waterworks system. And it didn't really cause outages. It didn't cause any, you know, issues that water customers would see. But it was interesting that they did not publicly acknowledge that there was an outage and they had to go to a backup system.
Yes.
Until your story.
You know what? Honestly, I got this from a reader who just like a regular person who is like, I know that you cover the city. I heard this. You guys, that's what a tip is. You don't have to say, I know everything about it. If you have a tip that's even like this and you want to know, just ask me. Because all it did, honestly, was during PG's trial in the summer. And I was like, I need to check this out because what if there were ongoing problems? And then Jackson, Mississippi happened where their whole downtown did not have water. And it's a big mess there related to their water system. And in my head, that question from a reader that was on my list to check out really became, could it happen here? And it did happen. The citizen knew everything and was right about it. Now, everybody's like, we're fine. It was a one-time thing. It was just this random. The backup didn't work for the backup. And the city bought water from Claremont County and nobody was the wiser. But, and I believe them that this was this one-time thing. I have some other public records requests in kind of following up on some extra questions, but I'm not like, oh, the sky is falling. But one of the experts I talked to, something he said really resonated with me, and it was in the story. And he said, you have to ask these questions, even if it's minor, so everyone can keep top of mind the big questions. And it doesn't become Jackson, Mississippi, that you're asking the questions, you're looking and you're knowing what's going on with your water system. It's your water. And so I thought that he made a really good point there. And I never mind checking out things, you guys.
No, and that's a good time or a good reminder that if you have a news tip, if you have a story that you want someone to check out, whether it be Sherry or Scott or any of our amazing reporters, you just send that to localnews@enquirer.com. And if you do, we'll be grateful.
Yes, and Robin, who manages our phones and all of our local inbox, she gets things to the right people. So let's give her a little shout out. You know, you have the unsung hero.
That's right.
She's taking the call, all the calls. That's and people call with heartbreaking stories that we can either help with or we don't, or we can't. And so she is a really good listener. So unsung hero award for Robin.
I agree with that.
All right. We really should get to it, though.
I'm excited to talk about New Riff and see what we can learn.
All right. Now that we've been through all of the news, and I mean all of it, it's time to welcome our special guest, Ken Lewis, owner of New Riff Distillery. Welcome, Ken.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Appreciate it.
So we're on the phone today. Where are you talking to us from?
I am on the third floor of the distillery and looking out at a beautiful day and looking at Bellevue and Newport, Northern Kentucky, and the Party Source. And it's a great view.
All right, Phil, pack it up. We're going across the river. Oh, no, sorry. We don't have time for that. That sounds lovely.
So, Ken, we thought it would be fun to talk to you. It is fall. I know that during the summer, people tend to gravitate towards different types of spirits. But once, you know, the weather cools off, bourbon, I think, is, you know, becomes the drink of choice for people as they want to warm up by the fire. And it's just a nice seasonal shift. But before we talk about that, I thought we would kind of like get into the Ken Lewis story for those who aren't familiar with your story. And I'll tee it up. You were previously known for the founder and owner of the Party Source, which somehow became one of the nation's largest liquor stores. And tell us a little bit about how that came to be.
Sure. Party Source, I was actually, I'm from originally, although I'm living up here and actually in Cincinnati now. But at the time, 30 plus years ago, I was living and working in Louisville, and I had three stores down there. They were alcoholic beverage stores, and to make a long story short, that was in the era, and no one's going to admit they're old enough to remember this, but that was in the era when Ohio had state stores, and the state stores were known for very poor service and sort of making people feel, yuck, you know, I'm buying alcohol, I must be something, you know, there must be something wrong with me. Women didn't want to walk in that. The prices were very high. And to me, operating in an open environment, in Louisville, a highly competitive environment, to come up here with the same techniques of pricing and tremendous diversity of product, including non-alcoholic goods like party goods and gourmet foods, and to come up here and be a stone's throw from Ohio looked like a heck of a good bet. And I'm happy to say that indeed turned out to be true, and it quickly became my best store and had the greatest potential. And later on, I actually sold the stores in Louisville. They're now a chain. They were the beginning of a chain called Liquor Barn, which still exists today in Kentucky. And I operated the Party Source here on the border of Bellevue and Newport for about 22 or 3 or 4 years. And then the next phase happened, which was selling the Party Source. And indeed, I sold it to the employees in an ESOP and building New Rift Distilling. So that became the second chapter. But the first chapter was taking advantage, frankly, of the border situation. Most of our customers at the Party Source were from Ohio, and Ohio had a lot of pretty sophisticated customers compared to maybe the rest of Kentucky. It became a great wine store, and it truly was taking advantage of the entrepreneurial insight into the marketplace.
And honestly, the employees at Party Source are amazing. There are a lot of them, and you can always go in there if you have questions about anything. It could be about the kind of alcohol you're looking for the dinner party you're having, or it could be, I'm having a party with this many people, what do I need? And so you can go in there. I think that really the employees, it's amazing that they bought it because they were really such a key part of the success, because you just couldn't get that at, you know, the liquor store that's closest to my house. Like I needed an expert a lot of times.
Yeah, there's tremendous selection and good knowledge, and I'd like to think that with the employee stock ownership plan and the fact that it's 100% employee owned, I'd love to think that that is continuing to be true. And I know factually that there's a much higher percentage of career long-term employees at the Party Source than you would find at a typical retail store. So I think it's working. And just a quick note that selling the company, I still own the real estate, but selling the company to the employees was really one of my finest memories and moments in life. And you know, to be able to do well financially for myself and my family, create an iconic retail business like the Party Source, but then to impact 50, 100 plus families and help supplement their ultimate retirement, pass back the profitability that they work for every day is really, for my value system, a wonderful dream. And for any of your listeners that own businesses and thinking about succession planning and so forth, it's a little harder, a little more work, but in the end, it's ultimately very gratifying to use the ESOP system. And to sell to your own employees and watch that legacy grow throughout the community.
So are you often consulted when business owners are thinking of selling a store in a similar fashion to the employees?
I certainly have. It's not been anything official. I'm a big participant and booster of the Gehring Center at University of Cincinnati, which is all about family businesses, and succession and transition is an important topic. So I've been involved in that a little bit. And it's been more on an anecdotal kind of basis. Someone hears, Party Source is an ESOP. Why don't you go talk to Ken? I know it. That kind of thing. I'm in my early 70s, and I'm contemplating our own succession is actually in the works here at New Riff. And that actually is something I would love to do more in semi-retirement, is just gratis work with family businesses that maybe had given that alternative a thought, other than just selling to a competitor or the highest bidder. But what about the folks that help make that wealth for you? If there was a vehicle and there's tax advantages to it, banks are willing to lend and so forth, let's talk. It's a little harder work, but it's very, very gratifying. So I do hope to do more of that.
That sounds amazing to us who are, we work for a big corporation. And that's just not normally the corporate America approach. But, hats off to the small business owners that are committed to that. So I have a quick personal story to share about your selection. And then my question will be, how in the world do you come across and find and stock such a wide selection? But I was visiting family in Greece, and there's a spirit called Metaxa. Mm-hmm. And it comes in different varieties based on how long it's aged. And, the cheaper is the 3-star. You can get a 5-star or a 7-star. Mm-hmm. And when my cousin was dropping me off at the airport in Athens, there was a billboard size ad in the Athens airport for 12-star Metaxa. And I asked my cousin about it. I'm like, 12-star Metaxa? And he's like, oh, that's really hard to get. And I'm like, yeah, well, I bet. So I come home and I'm like, missing all the food and wine and things like Metaxa and ouzo that you can, that you partake in when you're in Greece. And I thought, I'm just on a whim, I'm going to look and see what the Party Source Metaxa selection is. And there it was, on the border of Newport and Bellevue, Kentucky, the coveted 12-star Metaxa.
Have I had this drink?
Your husband has at the last Enquire holiday party.
Oh, he was raving about it.
I reluctantly opened the bottle and shared. How in the world do you research and acquire and stock such a wide variety?
Well, that was part of that's a great story. Thank you for sharing it. Again, I no longer own the Party Source, but obviously for 23, 4, 5 years, whatever it was, I was intimately involved on a day-to-day basis. And again, as a regional story, you have, because we viewed all of Southern Ohio, all of Greater Cincinnati, including Northern Kentucky, as our customer base. And when you have that kind of a base, and again, a more sophisticated environment like we have in Cincinnati proper, a lot of educated people, a lot of wealth, a lot of well-traveled folks, a lot of wine folks. And you have opportunities that a smaller store locally, a local business, neighborhood business, just doesn't have. So from the beginning, again, we did not want to just be another store trying to undercut the prices in Ohio by a dollar a bottle. That's okay. That's fine. But I always set sights higher. We're doing that at New Riff, setting sights higher. And we really wanted to be a great store. And it's a heck of a lot more interesting to go the extra mile and try and find a lot of the interesting products and become intimately familiar with them. Because the products from around the world, whether they're wine or spirits like the Metaxa, et cetera, they reflect the culture and the agriculture and the environment of countries and civilizations all around the world. So really, honestly, selfishly, because I thought it'd be a great business model, but also because it's a heck of a lot more interesting to learn about new products, find ways to bring them in. And then there's so many, when people find something like that you can't find anywhere else in 2 or 3 or 4 state region, you've got a customer for life. So it's good business.
Well, let's now segue to, you know, you have this amazing business. You were at the helm for 20 years. Most people would say, you know, I've got the feather in my cap. I'm going to put
right.
my arms back and enjoy life now. Not too many people say, you know what? I'm going to sell it off and start over and create a, a distillery where none exists. Talk a little
Precisely.
Bit about
in 2014. Well, so it's not that
yeah,
long
we
ago.
Opened in 2014. So all this was transpiring in 2010, 2011, 2012, and so forth. The answer is a personal thing. The magic of small business at its best is it allows an individual to exercise their own personality, their own dreams and vision for the future. And I am a true entrepreneur, and I say that cautiously, but I know that it's true because I tolerate risk better than other people. So I'm just one of those, call it an adrenaline junkie, whatever it is. I want to be out there on the edge. And so, frankly and honestly, retailing is really hard work. And I did it for 30 plus years. And, you know, it's every holiday, it's weekends when you're doing it well and you're leading by example. It's tough work being a retailer. And hats off to all great retailers. And I was a little burned out, but also, in a way, and it's an odd thing to say, and it's completely crazy and contrary to what the vast majority of smart people would think. But kind of success and the easy path just didn't appeal to me as a way to finish my career. And I know that's crazy. Just when I sold the Party Source, it was 100% paid for, including the real estate it sat on. It was a cash cow. And to sell it and to move into something brand new that was certainly possible, but it is still a risk position, extreme. Certainly struck the average person, 99% of the people who would hear a story like that is completely crazy. And what is wrong with this guy?
What about your family?
All I can say is it thankfully it's turned out well. The Party Source is doing great for its employees, and I'm so thrilled for them. And then New Riff is booming, and we're doing well. We're creating a great brand for Greater Cincinnati, something we can all be proud of. And luckily, it's worked out because otherwise, I certainly would have been the fool talked about for decades to come.
What was, you know, you talked about the response to average people. What was it like convincing your family?
I think my family understands me and has great confidence in my business acumen and perception. And after all, it's an allied field, and the bourbon boom was pretty extant or obvious to a lot of people. I had good support from the family. But what I always told my own family was, look, most people, you know, as we're in middle age and doing well, want to put money in the bank, want to put money in the stock market. All the money we have is going to be in barrels. And you know what? That ain't so bad. You can touch them. You can feel them. They're too heavy to steal. It's not a bad way to go. And they would laugh and go, sure, do whatever you're going to do.
That's fantastic. So before we get into what makes New Riff special, I think for the benefit of me and other people who enjoy bourbon but probably don't know enough about it, can you give us a little bourbon 101? Like what makes a bourbon, and how is it different from what we call a whiskey? And hopefully that'll kind of set up the table so we can talk about
sure.
what's special about New Riff.
Well, you know, obviously this is something you can talk quite a bit about. We're going to be real quick about this. And it's, you know, the old expression about sparkling wine versus champagne. So all champagne is sparkling wine, but hardly all of sparkling wine is champagne because it's a delimited area of France. It's a geographic area of France that the grapes have to be grown and processed in. Similarly, there's whiskey all over the world. There's Japanese whiskey and Irish whiskey and Scotch whiskey and bourbon whiskey and rye whiskey. And, you know, the beat goes on. There's whiskey made all over the world. And essentially, whiskey just considered for the moment a brown good, a brown spirit. So there's whiskey everywhere in the world. But the federal government, the United States, passed a law basically in 1964 that gave providence that bourbon whiskey has to be made in the United States. Now, most people think it has to be made in Kentucky, and I'm happy for everyone to continue to think that, but it's not true. And for all I know, there's a Hawaiian bourbon, because bourbon's so popular. Bourbon has to be made in the United States. It has to be a majority corn-based. It has to be, and I'm hitting just a few highlights, it has to be aged in new oak charred barrels. And that's really the outer limits of what makes bourbon. So all bourbon is whiskey, but hardly all whiskey is bourbon. It's just another type, like scotch and Japanese whiskey and so forth.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but it doesn't take a lot of rye for something to be known as a rye whiskey. It's like, what, more than half? Is that how that works?
It's pretty simple. It just means that it's a majority of the mash bill or the recipe has to be rye.
So 51% is all you
Precisely.
Would need.
Precisely.
Okay.
And then from there, it's up to you what else you put in it. Bourbon has to be at least 51% corn. What else fills out that mash bill is up to the distillery.
All right. I think we've laid the groundwork. So tell me about your vision when you decided you were going to make New Riff Bourbon.
Great. Again, why would someone sell the party soaps, this cash cow? You know, it clearly wasn't, if all I wanted to do was make money, the smart thing was just to keep running the party soaps for the next 30 or 40 years till I die. And it continues to be a great business. I wanted to accomplish something else, like the risk position, but also I wanted to create a brand. I wanted to, you know, as a retailer, you sell things that other people make. I wanted to make something. I wanted to create an iconic brand for Greater Cincinnati. I saw an opportunity. Here we are in Northern Kentucky. We're in Kentucky. We're also part of this fantastic metropolitan area, 2 million plus people, that at the time didn't have a single distillery. What a great opportunity. We can create this brand, and let's set our sights super high. Let's make a world-class whiskey right here in Northern Kentucky, right here in Greater Cincinnati. And I think we can do really well financially, take great care of our employees and our community, and build this wonderful brand that ultimately can be a legacy, and my family can continue it. My daughter is in the business right now. And it's something that I could be super proud of going forward, and I think our entire community could be proud of. And I think we're on our way. I mean, we have a long way to go, but it's very, very gratifying, and things have worked out very nicely in that regard. We simply want to become, maybe it's a simple statement and incredibly complicated to accomplish, we want to be one of the great small distilleries of the world. 20 years from now, we want people to talk about New Riff at the same time they're talking about McCalla, or they're talking about, Woodford Reserve. We would be in the same breath as some great iconic whiskeys from all over the world. It's a very big goal, but man, it makes life worthwhile.
I would say you definitely have achieved this goal, because when you're flipping through the New York Times, what savoring bourbon, Northern Kentucky is the headline, and what's the subhead? As new distilleries pop up across the United States, the region along the Ohio River remains a particularly exciting destination for spirits tourism, and you are featured prominently in this article.
That's true. When you're in the New York Times and anything away from the Cincinnati Inquirer.
You're fine, we understand.
Every single day. But the New York Times, the Washington Post, et cetera, you know that you're on your way somewhere.
So what about either the process or the ingredients makes this the quality product that you envisioned?
It's a great question. And I'll try and answer it fairly quickly. Clearly, we have invested whatever needed to be invested in the facilities and hiring great people, training them, giving them the great tools they need to get the job done, providing the highest quality ingredients. But at the end of the day, there's only essentially four things that go into a mash bill. It's incredibly simple. I mean, it's grains, and it's water. And you know, ultimately we use some yeast and for enzyme action. But there's very little that goes into a mash bill. The one thing I will mention is, and this is kind of, you know, this is heretical, and people are from Central Kentucky are going to come after me with pitchforks. But unbeknownst to anybody, turns out, in my humble opinion, it's not so humble, we have the best water source for making whiskey in Kentucky. It's not in Lexington. It's not in Louisville. We have an aquifer underneath us, and it's all over northern Kentucky because we're a bowl, and all this water comes off the hills of Cincinnati and the hills of northern Kentucky and the calcium limestone hills in northern Kentucky, and all this water has settled and comes underneath the river, and it's filtered through sand and silt under the river, and it's all settled in this big bowl in northern Kentucky under our feet. That is our water source. We go 100 feet down. It's 58 degrees year-round, and that goes right into our mash bill. And that is a unique water source because every other important distillery in Kentucky uses river water or city water, and they neutralize it. So they have a neutral water source, and we're putting a high mineral content water with great personality from this region into our mash bill. We think that's a very important differentiator.
Is the aquifer actually on your property, or do you have to buy the water from an aquifer?
No, it's right on our property. It's actually over hundreds and hundreds of acres here, the flat area of northern Kentucky from the river till the hills start. It's all over this area, all along Covington, Newport, Bellevue, all the way down to Silver Grove. It's all along here.
Did you drill a well?
Yeah, we've got a well. And the thing I mentioned about the 58 degrees, which matters so much to us and to the world today, we are a very environmentally friendly distillery because distilleries use a tremendous amount of water for cooling. And where ours comes out at 58 degrees, right under our feet, we don't pay for it. We have permits, of course, the EPA and the state and so forth. But it comes right out. It's free to us. It's 58 degrees. We don't have to have a great big chill tower pumping all, using a lot of electricity. So incredibly fortuitous. And I know they're coming for me with pitchforks from Lexington. We've got the best water in northern Kentucky. I know everybody's laughing right now. All of your listeners are laughing. We have got, in northern Kentucky, we can make the best whiskey in Kentucky.
Regular listeners will remember that we had Michelle Hobbs on from the OTR Stillhouse, and she was still working, even though the aquifer is under her property, she was talking about the difficulties, Ohio, the red tape in Ohio to get to her own aquifer water underground. I should check back with her and see how that went. But she was saying the same thing, and I love that makes us special.
It gives us a little special, but, you know, it's not an argument you're going to win very often in a bar in Lexington, but you can try.
How do you get down in the aquifer? Do you, like, climb down in on a ladder, or how far underground is it?
It's a well. It's a traditional well, and it's 100 feet down is where we tapped it.
Okay. That is something I didn't know. I probably should have known. But I bet you're right. Our listeners are laughing, and they're also going, I did not know that. So a little bit more about the facility. Do you store all the barrels on site?
We store them all in northern Kentucky. We have actually our production campus is 10 minutes away in West Newport, right along Route 9. Some beautiful old historic buildings that we've restored. And that's where right now all our barrels go to age, and then that's where they're dumped and the filling occurs and the shipping out to distributors around the U.S. and so forth.
And
we're
minimum
now building a third campus, which is in Silver Grove, which is directly east along the river from where I sit right now. And we're building a 55,000 square foot barrel storage building right now to accommodate our continuing growth.
And we'll go back to that growth in a minute. What is the minimum time that a bottle of New Riff is stored before you start filling the – or a barrel of New Riff is stored before you start bottling?
Well, the minimum to call it straight whiskey on a label in the United States is 2 years. Our standard is bottled and bond, which, again, we won't get into all the rules, but it's an old definition of quality. It has to be 100 proof, and it has to be at least 4 years old. So our minimum age is 4 years old. We've already got some six-year-old products out there, and gradually we're going to have older and older products. That's when our reputation will really get established, when we have 8-year and 10-year and 12-year-old whiskeys of different kinds for people to try. That's when the magic will really start out.
So when will the first 8-year-old aged product be available?
We're not sure if we'll release at 8. We may go to 9. If we go to 9 years old, and something we're talking about now, that would be in 2025. So we're getting close. We are getting close. We have a 6-year-old 100% malted rye, which is my personal favorite, which is out now. Older and older product, we're going to continue to have 9 years, 12 years, et cetera, et cetera. And we're putting a lot of barrels away and not selling them now, just so that we can have a lot of product. That will establish our reputation.
Do you take it around and there's like bourbon competitions like all over the world and you take it and have it judged?
We do a little bit of that. It's a a bit of a scam, a little bit of a, you know, everybody, a lot of these competitions, almost all of them are money makers for this people who put them on. You do have $500 a brand or entry fee, et cetera, et cetera. You know, and there's a diminishing return on the metals that one gets. You know, it's a San Joaquin Valley County Fair. I got a gold medal. You know, who cares? There's a couple of competitions, particularly the San Francisco Spirits Competition, that are considered worldwide to set the standard. And we enter a couple of those that are really the benchmarks for the whole, really for the world of whiskey. And we've done well, by the way. Our first blew us out. But we submitted five products, four whiskeys, let's say. The first year we had them available, but they were 4 years old, and all four of them got a gold medal.
Wow.
Which was a big deal. And here's the thing about the, you know, it's a subjective thing. We've never been 4 out of 4 since. We've been 3 out of 4. We've got a silver here, you know. Best of show, all these things. We've never been 4 out of 4 or 5 out of 5 since, but our very first year we were. But anyway, it sure made us feel good.
Must be the water.
And I've got accolades now. I've got true believers happening right in front of me. It's fantastic.
Were you a bourbon person before you started New Riff and had, is it like beer where you were doing some home mixing of this recipe? And you just, it was a hobby to start, or did you kind of start fresh with the business?
The answer is no. I'm essentially a wine person all those years at the Party Source. And I'm perfectly honest, I do not have a good palate. I never had a good palate for wine either, by the way. I know what's good, I know what's bad, but get me into all the adjectives and descriptors and things and I've become lost. Just let me drink something. So I've really learned a lot, and I saw bourbon as a great opportunity for not just for me and my family, but for the community and for Greater Cincinnati. I saw a tremendous opportunity, and I jumped on it. And now, in the last years, I've certainly learned a tremendous amount. I still don't have a good palate, but I do drink a little more bourbon than I used to. That's for sure.
So in the minute or so we have left, can you tell us what we have to look forward to coming from New Riff in the months ahead leading into the winter?
Sure. Actually, I'll mention something briefly because we're always growing and expanding. It's a tough economic model because you make something and have to wait 6 years or more or whatever to sell it. But we're getting close and we're going to convert our third floor, which has been an event center, done a lot of weddings up there and things. We're going to convert that into a really sophisticated and enjoyable tap room, not really a tap room, tasting room and bar so that we could start showcasing all of our products. We're not really trying to be a bar. We're not in competition with the banks, et cetera. But a real educational facility, an enjoyable way where you can come in anytime and sit down in a beautiful environment with people who are very, very knowledgeable about whiskey and try all of our different products and learn something about them and do flights and do a little blends with some of your neighbors at the neighboring table, make your own a little bit. Just bring a lot of exciting education. And that's just, we haven't really talked about it. We're getting ready to kick that off after the first of the year. But we're excited because I think that extends our brand and brings another tourism and enjoyable opportunity into the Northern Kentucky, Greater Cincinnati.
So that'll be after the first of the year, you said?
Pardon?
That's after the first of the year?
Construction. Well, I would rather set my sights on fall for the opening, but we haven't talked about that at all. And so,
now that you've said it publicly, there's going to be people asking you every day. So
that's quite all right.
Put the pressure on.
And you are a stop on the Kentucky Bourbon Trail.
We are. We're on the craft trail. It's just we don't do the big busloads of people that just want their passport stamped. But tourism is huge in bourbon in the state of Kentucky. And we see Cincinnati as the Cincinnati Convention and Visitors Bureau. Everyone sees it. So does Northern Kentucky. The tourism opportunity, because most of the people that are going down to Central Kentucky or Louisville from out of state are coming right past us on 71 and 75. And we want to continue to get more and more of those people to spend a night or two in our community, going to our restaurants, bars, and our tasting rooms, in the fall and so forth. And we're making inroads and we're going to keep going at it. It's a community-wide effort.
All right, so the last question, and it's going to be a geeky bourbon question, and I'm going to try to do my best not to sound stupid, but at a recent birthday, my wife and I ended up at the bourbon bar that's outside of the Jungle Gyms in Fairfield, which is a cool experience. They've converted an old dry cleaners conveyor belt or conveyor track and equipped it so that if you're ordering an obscure bourbon, they hit this button and it click, 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 click comes around and the bottle comes, to the bar and all of that. It's just really fun. But, because it was my birthday, she convinced me to try Pappy Van Winkle, which I had never tried. It's like super rare, hard to get. And the bartender was pretty knowledgeable. He was telling me that, I was like, well, which one should I try? Because they had like a 12, I'm going to make up these years, but in the ballpark, like a 12 year and a 14 year or 17 year and like a 22 year or 23 year or something like that. And of course, each one is more expensive. And he told me, he said, don't necessarily go for the 23 year because even though it's the most aged and most expensive, the sweet spot is actually somewhere around 15 or 16 years that 20 plus years in the barrel is too much, tastes too oaky, little harsh. The sweet spot, he was telling me, was around the 17 year mark. What do you think the sweet spot is going to be for your classic, either straight or blended or single malt, New Riff bourbon? What do you anticipate the sweet spot will be for you?
It's a great question and a big topic that's clearly the bourbon geeks and whiskey geeks talk about all the time. I completely agree with that bartender. Jungle Gyms is an awesome business and I admire it tremendously. I've been a customer there, for all the time I've been up here. I agree with that bartender. The 21-year-old Pappy Van Winkle or any 21-year-old American whiskey is too woody. You're absorbing too much wood from the barrel. Just real quick, the climate in Scotland, when you talk about a 21-year-old Scotch whiskey and a 21-year-old American whiskey, you're not talking about the same thing because the climates are so dramatically different. Look at our humidity, look at our heat. And Scotland, it's rainy and cool pretty much year-round and overcast and so forth. Things age much quicker in the United States. So I agree completely. In my opinion, it's actually younger. I think the New Riff will show best at 12, 13, 14 years old. And I think our 12-year-old, when we finally have it, which is not that far off, 6 years or so, 7 years, I think that's going to be a wonderful product. And we are absolutely committed to keeping that price under $100 and make it available so it's not just one of these collector things, which people buy and they resell them or keep them as trophies and they don't drink them. I want people to drink our 12 or our 14-year-old whiskey and enjoy it. So.
Well, now we have something to look forward
exactly.
to.
Exactly.
You're very kind.
Ken, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me and enjoy the beautiful fall weather and have a bourbon to enjoy it with.
I cannot thank Ken for being here. I learned so much from this. I'm going to go home and Alex Coolidge is going to be like, who are you? When I start talking about all the bourbons we have in the house, which are a lot of them.
I think you're going to be a bourbon expert now.
This is a good one. For those paying close attention, you learned something today. Burl is so fun. He throws a good Christmas party. He clearly has good birthdays. So I love that about him. And I recently, almost by accident, had a night out with him that was pretty spectacular.
Yeah, somehow we ended up at the new Jeff Ruby's on opening night.
Now, Burl and I are going to talk about this, but first I have to encourage
It was a work excursion for Keith Pandolfi, our food writer.
To read Keith Pandolfi's story because I could not have said it better myself. Now, that's almost everything that Keith writes because he's an amazing writer and storyteller, but he really hit the mark on things. So Burl and I will talk about some of our favorite things, but please, you know, take a look at that story because he summed it up really nicely. And he's not like me because I run over to City Hall and I write a story really fast. And Keith lets things kind of ruminate and thinks about them. And then he was finally ready to write and he wrote something and he just didn't dash it off.
And with that story is a photo gallery. So if you haven't been to the new Jeff Ruby's and you want to see what all the fuss is about, there's some great photos in there that were shot by Sam Green, our photographer. And there's a few photos in there shot by you, Sherry, and me because, you know, We're not too bad with an iPhone if we
No,
have to.
There was some, and it was helpful because there was media availability before our dinner, kind of like the opening night ribbon cutting, which was lovely. Brittany Ruby was so choked up. It was cute to watch her with her dad.
And let's be honest.
Before people were in there, we could take some pictures, which was nice.
That's true. I mean, it was a big moment for the city. We talked about this before when Jeff and Brittany were in here, but
I love that episode.
You know, when Macy's moved out of that prime location on Fountain Square, it was kind of a punch in the gut for downtown enthusiasts. And that area has recovered nicely. It's being redeveloped. And you have now, you know, Jeff Ruby's signature steakhouse that was down on 7th is right in Fountain Square. So great news as far as, you know, bringing life back to the kind of Fountain Square area, the heart of downtown. But so let's reflect on that night.
Okay.
What did you expect and what was it like when you actually saw what they had put together?
I expected the same high quality that we're used to for Jeff Ruby's, melded with what I had seen previously in Nashville with the very special bar with the piano kind of on top of behind the bar for like really like an energy for that, how it's going to be filling the bar area. But I was blown away beyond even what I could imagine. It is every little detail is thought out down to the nth degree.
Right. And, you know, they've said this many times, like, you know, this is a place you go for special occasions. They're very unapologetic about that. You know, there's plenty of places to go get a great meal in town. But when you have something to celebrate, they want you to think Jeff Ruby's. And so you walk in and it does feel special. Even though we heard them describe it, when they describe, for example, the Jeff Ruby room with the onyx floors that are lighted from below, I'm like, okay. But you see
beautiful.
It? I mean, yeah, there's things in there you won't see. It's fun because it's – some people will say, you know, oh, my gosh, it's over the top and tacky. But it's – they somehow made it like crazy –
you know, as far as like over the top, but classy and tasteful too.
Because it's Art Deco. Like, it took it back to a very specific period with the red velvet booths and just the shape of them. And so it didn't feel over the top because Art Deco is Art Deco for a reason.
What else? What was your what was your either favorite thing to eat or favorite experience of the night?
Well, I had a little bit to drink before this part, but I don't think that has anything to do with this. They do have two amazing, really made for social media, but delicious at the same time desserts.
Instagrammable desserts. Yes. Yeah.
One of them is the Ruby Vuitton, like a little Louis Vuitton purse shaped cake that was lighter than air and just delicious. And then they had an Air Force shoe, which is was all chocolate. And we had a big debate about which one we liked better, but the Louis Vuitton one, and not because it was a Louis Vuitton, because it's the best cake I ever had.
The best ever.
The best ever.
So,
and I took home the leftovers, so I can actually say this with.
So one of my favorite things was, and they pulled out all the stops for opening night, but they had a guy going around doing tableside cocktails. And I have dabbled with incorporating smoke into cocktails. And I have this very, like, primitive way to do it, you know. When I experimented with this, I wanted to get one of those, like, culinary torches that you would use to, you know, finish off a creme brulee. You know, they're, like, handheld. They have a little butane cartridge in and creates a little flame. I couldn't find one of those. When I was shopping, it was like, you know, the pandemic was still messing up supply chains. And I went to a couple of different places and they're like, yeah, we haven't had those for a while. Might be able to order one. And I was like, screw it. I have a like torch that I use for minor plumbing repairs, you know, the kind that you can buy at Home Depot and,
okay,
and a little brass fitting, right?
So I brought a little bit of ingenuity.
So I brought that up from the garage and I found, you know, some cedar planks that you would use to do salmon. And I basically light the wood on fire in the kitchen.
Has the fire department been to visit? I'm just
curious. No, and I haven't set off the smoke detectors yet. And then once you get, you know, a little bit of flame going and some smoke, you take the glass and you like put it on top and you trap the smoke in the glass for a little while and then you kind of make the cocktail. And it does give it that smoky flavor. But this guy had
all the things.
He had this thing. It looked like it came out of a laboratory, like a flask, and it was heated and like, I don't know what he was doing, but all of a sudden this like flask like filled up with smoke and on top of it was this thing that connected the glass to it. So while he's kind of mixing the cocktail, you have this like smoke just like bellowing up into this glass. And so, I mean, it was a nice tasting cocktail, but it's the show. I mean, you're there for the whole experience. It's not just a culinary experience. It's like a full sensory overload. And they pulled it off. So it was fun.
I know. When are we going back? No, I'm just kidding.
I'm not going back. I'm telling you, I had to go on a hunger strike the next 2 days just to like, you know, be able to fit into my pants again. That was kind of a, you know, like a special occasion. But hats off to them.
If you can, I highly recommend going out for a meal with Keith because he knows how to order.
Well, that's funny you say that because Keith doesn't know this yet, but you know, I'm doing Real Men Wear Pink.
Yes. It's a pink polo shirt.
I have a pink polo shirt. It's got the Real Men Wear Pink logo on it. I might try to talk him into letting me auction off dinner with Keith for, you know, with the proceeds going to Real Men Wear Pink.
If he doesn't mind, I love that idea because it was special to watch him order. Even when we were going there, we kind of always get the same thing. And I was like, we really should let Keith kind of guide the way because he's the expert, and he was.
Well, and you know, I've been out with Keith a couple of times just for lunches and things like that. It's very fun. He's very knowledgeable, but he's not all about fancy all the time. Like if you read and follow Keith, he's just as comfortable. He did an amazing story about a chili parlor because it is the 100th anniversary of Cincinnati Chili.
You don't say.
So much we could be talking about right now when it comes to Cincinnati moments, but and I didn't even know this. There's a 90-plus-year-old Greek guy that owns the A&A restaurant in Mount Healthy who still goes into work every day, still makes the chili, and is still there holding court with customers and things like that. You know, one of probably the most, like, dated, diviest, but friendliest hole-in-the-wall chili parlors you could go to. And Keith went there and wrote an amazing story. So
I love my job, but he is a very good
job. Yeah, he's got the job. He has the job of jobs. So anyway.
All right, you guys. Thanks for listening. We'll let you know what Burl decides to do about Real Men Wear Pink and donating and helping out a really good cause.